Welcome to the China Meaning Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. When we talk about Gulf-Asia relations, which we do a lot these days, the focus tends to be economic. Most of the top trade partners of GCC countries are in Asia, where there's a huge appetite for Gulf energy. On top of energy trade, there's significant contracting, labor flows, and investment. At the same time, Asian geopolitics are complex, and tensions between Asian powers could affect Gulf countries' economic and strategic interests. To discuss how people in the Gulf are thinking about the consequences of a growing Asian presence, I'm delighted to be talking today with Dr. Hassan Al-Hassan. Hassan is a senior fellow for Middle East policy at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, or IISS, based in Manama, Bahrain. He has deep experience as a scholar and practitioner of foreign policy in the Gulf region, including serving as a senior analyst on foreign policy and national security for the Crown Prince of Bahrain's staff. He specializes in Arab Gulf states' grand strategies, economic statecraft, and relations with Asian powers. And his most recent book is India in the Gulf, Theoretical Perspectives and Policy Shifts, which looks fantastic. I haven't got my hands on it yet, but I can't wait to. He co-edited this with Harsh V. Pant. Hassan, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure, and I've been following your show for quite some time. And as I said when we were off the air, I think you're doing a fantastic public service to the field of scholarship, really, on China-MENA relations. So this really is a fantastic one-stop shop for anyone interested in the topic, and I'm grateful to you for hosting me.
Well, thanks, man. That's great to hear. I mean, you've been doing great stuff yourself. I see you are doing a lot of media these days, and a lot of, you're all over the place providing really good commentary. So I think folks should definitely be paying attention to you on what I guess LinkedIn is where you post most things. Are you using Twitter or X or Blue Sky or any of these?
Twitter or X as well, but mostly LinkedIn. I find the stream to be very well tailored there. So.
Yeah, we'll put links to all of your social media stuff on the show page so everybody can follow you and keep track of all the great stuff you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Of course. So look, I want to start just with a kind of a general overview question. We both spend a lot of time thinking about Asian countries' engagement in the Gulf. Of course, you are one of the top guys on India, Asia, and the region. I'm thinking about China a lot. They're both major economic partners. There's a lot of people-to-people stuff happening. There's a lot of educational engagement, cultural engagement. There's political and economic cooperation. How do you explain this? What's driving this deeper levels of cooperation between Asian countries that 10 or 20 years ago weren't very active here, and today they're a big part of the story?
Absolutely, and I think the big change has really been about the relations between Asian and Gulf states, right? Because on the level of people-to-people relations, those are obviously very old. They stretch way back. I recently co-edited along with Philippe Petria and Aurélie Varel, a special issue of Arabian Humanities, looking really at various aspects of South Asia and Arabian Peninsula's relations stretching back hundreds of years. And obviously these crystallize in many, many shapes. But I think, the novelty here that you refer to over the past 15 to 20 years is really the interstate relations between China, India, and the GCC states, to be very precise. And I think, one very significant factor to my mind that explains these deeper levels of cooperation, I think has to be located very broadly within how the Gulf states' own strategies have evolved and taken shape over the past two decades. I think, over the past 15 to 20 years, the Gulf states, and especially the UAE, Saudi Arabia, to a lesser extent, Qatar, have really converged on a strategy that consists of making themselves indispensable to as many strategically significant global actors as possible, and then leveraging those relations, I think, to obtain preferential access to technology, ensure supply chain resilience, potentially derive defense and security benefits, and so on. But it's really at heart, I think, an indispensability strategy that takes aim at, the great powers, but also at rising powers. And I think India and China have a special place in the strategy for the Gulf states because for different reasons. I mean, the relationship with India obviously is older, it's more organic, there are deep-rooted diasporic cultural ties, But it also takes, I think, a strategic element when it comes to things like food security and public health. And we've seen how the Gulf states have been able to leverage their relationship with India to obtain preferential access to Indian exports of rice or onions or vegetables and things like that, even when India has put export restrictions in place. With China, I mean, the relationship is more recent. It comes from a place of, I think, mutual historical ignorance, but also distrust, given China's role in supporting communist movements in the region. But I think it's a relationship that speaks particularly well to the Gulf states' technological needs and ambitions. And I think, takes on obviously special geopolitical significance because of the U.S.-China rivalry. And this, I mean, whether we like it or not, is also related to the way the Gulf states see the United States and the way that the U.S.'s role has been evolving. Primarily, I think, because the Gulf states perceive the U.S.'s security role as evolving from that of somewhat of an ambiguous security guarantor to a defense partner. And I think that has implications. But I also think that they see the growing geopolitical frictions that are eroding the neoliberal paradigm, the global economy. To them, this carries far-reaching implications that they have to adapt to. And so they really have to, I think, exercise agency. They can no longer rely on U.S. protection and U.S. global economic leadership. I think they, acutely perceive the need to exercise greater agency and to become, geoeconomically indispensable to great and rising powers like China and India. And then, as I said, try and leverage that indispensability to navigate their own security and economic challenges.
So just building off that, I mean, I'm sure you get this question a lot too. I get it pretty much 3 or 4 times a week. Somebody will come to me and say, what is going on with BRICS Plus? Why are these countries reaching that way when so much of what they do with the U.S. is fundamental to their larger security policy or their political policy? But what you're describing makes it sound like when they're thinking about countries like China and India, this is a much more long-term vision of maybe what's coming next globally. Is that kind of how you see it?
I agree. I mean, when you look at BRICS Plus, it's quite interesting because I think it speaks, and especially for Saudi Arabia, it speaks to Saudi Arabia's ambitions to really have a seat at the table of global economic governance. And that's a trend that we see increasingly with Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia, for example, in addition to BRICS Plus, is part of the World Bank IMF roundtable on global debt restructuring. Right? And it's actually been working somewhat more closely with other non-Paris Club creditors like China, but also obviously with Paris Club creditors and multilateral institutions like the IMF and World Bank to not only perform and implement global debt restructuring, but also to rethink global debt restructuring. And so you really see Saudi Arabia, the amount of emphasis that the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, places on Saudi Arabia's membership of the G20, I think also, speaks volumes to how Saudi Arabia views its own role in the world. And you see that play out as well in OPEC Plus and the widening of membership of OPEC to a wider set of countries over the past several years. So I think you have essentially a real desire among the Gulf states, especially Saudi Arabia, to some extent the UAE and others, to have a seat at the global economic table. And I think China is seen, and China's rise is seen as providing somewhat of an opportunity for them to do that, primarily because the U.S. has traditionally always been reluctant to cede control of global economic institutions that were set up in the post-World War II context, and over which the U.S. essentially exercises de facto control. Whereas China seems to be more willing, I think, to create countervailing coalitions through BRICS Plus, to bring the Gulf states on board with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and potentially to act as a partner in its own right, along with the Gulf states, in trying to restructure, reshape some of the global economic institutions, like multilateral development institutions and in other areas like debt and so on. And so there are opportunities, I think. The Gulf states see an opportunity to work with China in really asserting the role as global economic actors, not only through trade and investment, but also through institutions and governance.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, I mean, if you look at most of the PRC's foreign policy, you know, up until about 2013 when the BRI was announced, it really was kind of focused inwardly and it was very much a, you know, a regional power that wanted to have global respect, but it didn't really seem to be much of a global actor. And even with the BRI, I mean, it seemed to have pretty significant global trading power, but in things like global governance, we didn't see a big footprint. And then, you know, in the past few years, there's been this new wave of, you know, the global development initiative, the global security initiative, the global civilization. You know, China seems to be presenting alternative norms for global governance with a big emphasis on the global. And I was at a workshop in Udaipur last month, and it was interesting because I saw the same pattern in India. Like often when Indians spoke about international politics, it was really South Asian politics, right? You didn't see kind of an ambition to be playing a deeper role globally. But that seems to have changed. A lot of the people attending this workshop spoke of India as a leading power. People said it has global interests now. As Indian and Chinese self-perceptions start to change like this, do you think people in the Gulf are starting to see them differently? Are they starting to look at this and think of them beyond economic actors and see them in more strategic terms?
Most certainly. And I entirely agree with you. I think India, you know, I concentrated and focused on China in my remarks so far, but India as well sees itself as a leader of the global South. And that was specifically the framing that India chose to use, I think, during its presidency of the G20, and has tried to push and really position itself as the voice of the global South. In a sense that also implicitly, I think, excludes China, because of the Indian mindset, you know, China has no place in the global South. You know, that might be a crude articulation of it, but I think implicit in the way India seems to frame the global South, there seems to be an exclusion of China there. But I do agree that India sees itself as, you know, has a changing self-perception and sees obviously itself as having a global interest. And I think that these changing self-perceptions in China and India do resonate in the Gulf. And I think they are being viewed more strategically in the Gulf. And you know, that can take multiple forms. So in the very strict sense of the term, they are seen increasingly as defense and military partners. And so you see a rising pace of defense cooperation between India and the Gulf states, port calls, joint exercises, refueling, MOD to MOD relations, more frequent calls between, you know, chiefs of defense staff, and so on and so forth. And not only in the naval domain, which has been obviously the traditional area of India-GCC defense cooperation, but also beyond it. So you see now trilateral exercises encompassing more than one domain, land exercises, air exercises, refueling cooperation, and so on. So really, there has been a rising trajectory in India-GCC defense relations, especially under Modi. And I've recently written a chapter on this topic that has come out already. The China is not far behind in the sense that China also seems to be catching up in terms of naval exercises. They have exercises with Iran, with Saudi Arabia. They carried out air exercises with the UAE. You have a bunch of other Asian countries, I mean, beyond China and India, Japan, South Korea, a few others that are represented in the Combined Maritime Forces, for example, that are headquartered out of Bahrain. Beyond defense cooperation, there's, you know, obviously also arms sales. I know you've discussed this in much depth in some of the previous episodes on your podcast, with China, you know, making its presence felt in UAVs and counter UAV systems. South Korea obviously is also present in the air defense domain with UAE acquisitions of South Korean systems. And obviously, you know, beyond that, in civilian infrastructure, dual use, tech transfer, and so on. The point, I think, however, is that even the economic relationships between the Gulf states and, you know, China and India are taking on a strategic significance. So food security is obviously extremely important for the Gulf states, and India is a very significant actor there. Public health is also, I think, during the COVID-19 pandemic, was highly strategic. On the one hand, the Gulf states managed to get priority access to Sinopharm and took part in the Chinese vaccine or one of the Chinese vaccines and were part of the clinical trials. They also got access to the Indian variant of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, Covishield, and actually managed to get PPEs and healthcare workers dispatched from India, if only to look after the very large Indian diaspora that that lives in the Gulf. Beyond that, I think, energy is obviously a strategic sector for the Gulf states. And there you already see India, China, Japan and South Korea are the biggest export markets for the Gulf states. Obviously, India is expected to be, one of the main sources of growth in global oil demand until 2050. OPEC is very explicit about this expectation. But even beyond, I think, oil and gas, China is a contender both for Saudi Arabia's and the UAE's expanded nuclear programs, reportedly. So you see a Chinese footprint in the nuclear field, but also potential Chinese involvement in helping Saudi Arabia establish, the entire nuclear fuel cycle. But you also see it in renewables. I mean, India is trying to push forward the Solar Alliance. Diplomatically, that's interesting, but I'm not sure it's materializing in any significant way. But as far as China is concerned, I mean, 2 weeks ago, we hosted a representative of Aqua Power here at IISS to give a talk. And she was very upfront about the extent to which the entire supply chain on solar is Chinese dominated. The contractors that Aqua Power uses to carry out renewable energy projects are mostly Chinese. And that the Chinese are growing their footprint, even in hydrogen, around electrolyzers and so on, really eating up a lot of European market share in that sense. So I think, it's when we look at the strategic significance of Gulf Asian relations, they're very much there in the very strict defense and security sense, but also in the sense that these economic relationships around food, public health, energy take on strategic significance for the Gulf states. And I think that's very much resonating in Gulf thinking, for sure.
Well, I think the inverse is true, too, because when you mentioned the diaspora during the pandemic, one thing that kind of gets lost, the narrative is often about energy trade or investment or contracting. But, here in the UAE, they estimate that there's about 400,000 Chinese nationals living here, which is by far the biggest Chinese population in the Middle East. But that's really quite minor when you look at, the South Asian diaspora, especially the Indian, on this side of the Gulf. And that gives this set of countries a very, significant strategic relevance, I think, for governments in India and China, because in such an unstable or competitive region where you have these huge, population centers, that becomes a real hard security concern for governments. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think it's intricately linked to the naval and defense posture of especially India and the region. And so, keep in mind that some of the largest evacuations of Indian expatriates took place in the Middle East region. I mean, the biggest airlift, took place in Kuwait following the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. That was a massive operation. Over 100,000 Indians evacuated on planes, but also on Indian naval vessels. And then you had the Indian Navy essentially rescuing Indian expats from Lebanon, Yemen, Libya, and really incorporating the need to evacuate Indian personnel in emergency and conflict situations very much into the naval sort of doctrine and set of priorities that informs and guides, I think, India's naval posture and presence in the Gulf, but also in the wider, Western Indian Ocean region. And so the diasporic presence obviously takes on is, I think, as you said, very significant and very strategic for these large Asian countries. And I think it has implications beyond the diplomatic and political relations. It has defense and security implications for them as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think when you hear about some of what the Chinese People Liberation Army, Navy is doing in the region, and a lot of people get their hackles up, and I think okay, I understand the concern, but at the same time, if you use that strategic empathy and think, how are Beijing people in Beijing thinking about it? There's got to be an element of, you know, we had to move 30,000 plus people out of Libya, you know, 10 years ago. We had to move, I think, about 600 or 700 out of Yemen. What happens if things with Iran get really between Iran and Israel or whatever? Any nightmare scenario could create serious strategic problems for China. So it's something I think that really doesn't get emphasized enough in how people look at this. But I want to kind of look from outside the region in. And this is one thing that's always been very interesting to me. Before I moved to the Gulf, I spent pretty much all of my 20s bouncing between Taiwan and South Korea, which was tremendous fun. It was, you know, a great way to spend my 20s. I loved it. But it was terrifying for my parents and my wife's parents because, you know, we're in Taiwan in the late 90s when there's all these, you know, tensions between Taiwan and China. And then we were in South Korea when during the early 2000 to 2005 when there were a lot of tensions with North Korea. And it because of that experience, it always surprised me when I hear about the Asian model and the Asian miracle and Asia's nothing but economic growth and you know, blue skies ahead. My time in Asia made me really, very, very cognizant of these geopolitical tensions that exist across the region. And we saw, you know, not too long ago where Japan and South Korea were at odds and greater odds than usual. North Korea and South Korea, you see China and India, and you see China and India and Pakistan. And, you know, it's a really complex region, like I said in the intro. I'm wondering for Gulf countries that, you know, rely on Asian markets for so much of their exports, that rely on Asian labor for a lot of their contracting and things happening in the region, like how do these Asian geopolitical tensions feature in Gulf thinking? You know, are people watching things like the Taiwan Straits or China-India competition and thinking, whoa, this could really play out here in a way that we're not comfortable with?
So I think for the most part, it doesn't really register. And it's these Asian geopolitical tensions tend to be absent from the radar of most Gulf officials and, you know, most Gulf from the Gulf policy community, I think, generally speaking. I think the main exception to that could be India-Pakistan. I'll get to that in a minute. Maybe that's my personal bias because I look at South Asia and Afghanistan as well for historical reasons. But I think by and large, you know, if you look at the Taiwan issue, it doesn't really register. I think there is a significant amount of ignorance among, you know, professional diplomats, for example, in the Gulf, of dynamics in the South China Sea or in the Taiwan Strait. Although that does seem to be changing somewhat, there isn't really a sophisticated Gulf view or Gulf position on how to position themselves, you know, the Gulf states, on these issues. You know, you ask, most Gulf officials or even diplomats that are looking after the region, you know, where their respective countries stand on the, you know, one China policy versus the one China principle and so on. And I don't think they'd, you know, be able to help you very much. I think, what explains this? I think it's partly seen as somewhat far away. It's lower on the list of salient geopolitical shocks that are more likely to have an impact on Gulf security. You know, it's already a busy and fairly dangerous neighborhood as is. The security dynamics are very much, you know, to a large extent self-contained, and I think only tangentially related to what goes on further east in the Asia-Pacific and in the Indo-Pacific. You've got, you know, high-intensity conflict in multiple theaters in the Middle East region. You have intense rivalries between regional powers. And so I think on the list of salient and pertinent threats that are likely to have an immediate impact on, you know, Gulf hard or economic security, I think regional issues loom much larger. And, you know, issues further away Taiwan Strait or the Indo-Pacific are paid less attention to. And I think it's also partly goes to the fact that there's anyway very little that the Gulf states can do about those dynamics. And so why waste, you know, attention and energy looking very closely at something you can't really change? I think it's part of the prevailing attitude, whether articulated or not, towards some of these issues. Now, there are exceptions, as I mentioned at the beginning. India, Pakistan, I think, is different, partly because of the geographic proximity of these two nations, the diasporic element, the fact that Pakistan is a member of the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and has been, you know, very close to the Gulf states at the defense and security level for many decades. And so I think the India-Pakistan relationship, they're both, you know, Pakistan is a Muslim majority country. India has a very large Muslim population. And so it resonates, I think, somewhat differently. There's a high, you know, higher level of awareness. Afghanistan also, I think, is an exception, partly because of the, you know, the fact that the Gulf states were, Saudi Arabia in particular, was a significant actor during the 1980s and onwards, was invested with, you know, some of the Afghan groups fighting against the Soviet Union and even beyond. Saudi Arabia and the UAE were the only two countries other than Pakistan to have recognized the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan under the Taliban. And so the extent of Gulf investment in Afghanistan was, I think, partly because of the broader geopolitical dynamics, the relationship with political Islam, and so on, was significant to the extent that it warranted a greater degree of awareness and interest. And of course, I mean, Qatar's role in hosting the Taliban and facilitating the U.S. withdrawal and the U.S.-Taliban agreement that brought an end to NATO's presence in Afghanistan and essentially eventually paved the way for the Taliban to return to power, I think also means that there is a heightened sense of awareness as to geopolitical dynamics in the Afghan theater as well. But I would say these are the exceptions. I mean, you know, once you go beyond South Asia, the extent of awareness and interest, I think, declines significantly.
Yeah, that holds up. I mean, I think I've had this conversation with a lot of people over the past few years, and because it's kind of been at the front of my mind. And one of the things that keeps coming up is, you know, when you're in such a competitive region as the Gulf is, it really kind of overwhelms everything else, you know, and what, you know, the resources you have to devote, the time, you know, the energy you can think about other stuff. And if you look at, like you say, the South China Sea or you know, Japan and North Korea and China and this strange triangle in Northeast Asia, you know, if you're not a naval power region, you have a limited capacity to affect events, then it's going to probably drop on the agenda. I saw a similar dynamic. So last year, my friend Lee Chen Sim, we did a co-edited book where, kind of looking from the opposite direction, we asked a lot of Asian Gulf specialists, you know, if the region is seen as in some sort of transition, as the U.S. role is less clear and there's competition between China and the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. And your countries have deep economic interests in the region, and you're dependent on energy as Japan and Korea are from the region. Does this make this more strategically important for you? And so we got people from these countries, I think it was Japan, Korea, China, India, Pakistan, and Singapore, to write case studies. And almost everybody came back with the same logic you're describing. You know, like, look, we're in really competitive regions ourselves. You know, South Korea, say, we're still at war with North Korea. If we divert military resources to the Gulf, knowing there's a limited role of what we can do, this would be, you know, foreign policy suicide in a democracy. People would be calling for our, you know, knock us out of office immediately in Japan with its limited ability, constitutional limitations on what it can do. So, yeah, we saw a similar dynamic that almost, and it's not a surprise, right? I think everybody's concerns are what's right in front of us, what's closer to home. Related to this, I want to ask you, because you also mentioned the Indo-Pacific in your last response, and this has become such a dominant framework for so many countries and how they see, you know, what was, when I was in, well, really up until like 10 years ago, the Asia Pacific, what we'd grown with for a long time. I've lost track of how many countries have released Indo-Pacific strategies, but no Gulf countries have, as far as I can tell. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I did a project that was published last year, and at that point, we didn't see any public or official documents on the Indo-Pacific from Gulf countries. You rarely hear the phrase used when golf leaders speak officially. What do you think accounts for this?
I agree. There has been an absence of overt thinking about the Indo-Pacific. I mean, you don't see, as you said, the GCC states releasing Indo-Pacific strategies, but I think for good reason, to be honest. I think it is indicative of the notion that the Gulf states view the various states and groupings that are constitutive of the geography we often refer to as the Indo-Pacific through their own terms, and sort of on their own terms and through their own or through the prism of their own interests. Because ultimately, I think the Indo-Pacific, you know, is a geopolitical construct that really alludes to China's military and economic rise and the challenge that it constitutes to what has traditionally been a US-dominated security order of the Asia-Pacific. And I don't think that, you know, this would be a particularly helpful or useful lens for the Gulf states through which to view that part of the world. Partly, you know, as we mentioned, the security dynamics in which they're embedded are, I think, largely shielded from what goes on in the Indo-Pacific, in the MENA region, and the Gulf sub-region have their own internal logics. And so I don't think that the Gulf states have adopted what I think is essentially a Western framework for thinking about that part of the world. Because I think there is a mismatch between the geopolitical connotations of that you know, frame of reference and on the one hand, and the way that they perceive their own interests and preferences in that part of the world. Interestingly, there have been, and you know, not to mention that, you know, interestingly, I think we've seen clear attempts by India to incorporate the Gulf region, the Western Indian Ocean, as India likes to call it, into the Indo-Pacific construct. Because traditionally, the U.S. conception of the Indo-Pacific starts from the eastern shoreline of India. So it's, you know, India and then east of India. India, obviously, in its own self-perception, sees itself as the anchoring geography, the anchoring power, the anchoring country of the Indian Ocean, and has advocated for an extension of the Indo-Pacific framework further west to incorporate potentially the Gulf, but also even potentially the Red Sea or the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and so on. But I don't think there is, you know, broader recognition, it seems, of the utility of incorporating that part of the world into the Indo-Pacific construct and looking at the linkages and the relationships between the Gulf region, specifically from an energy perspective and broader dynamics in the Indo-Pacific. But I don't think that the Gulf states have been very eager to play along and really to redefine themselves as part of that geopolitical construct. I think they're more comfortable seeing themselves as part of the Arab world, of the Gulf, the Middle East, even the you know, West Asia. There are, you know, Gulf officials that you know, do find that term to be very useful, but not as part of a web of you know, rivalries and alignments that are centered around the U.S.-China great power competition in that part of the world. I think ultimately they see that as you know, unhelpful construct that could imply, at least to China, that they now see China in the same terms as you know, other members of the Quad and so on. It could, I think there's a risk that's perceived in the Gulf that if they were to adopt this frame of reference, that they could potentially inadvertently antagonize China. And I think that's something that they would want to avoid. I think it's a way for the Gulf states to really assert their non-alignment, so to speak, the notion that they really don't want to be a part of this great power competition, even if, of course, they will leverage it from time to time to serve their own interests.
Yeah, I think that's a really good explanation, you know, because reading a lot of Chinese responses to Quad or the Malabar joint exercises or just the Indo-Pacific in general, you know, they see this very much as a containment strategy. And, you know, I think depending on what your vantage point, the, you know, the Indo-Pacific can be a lot of different things. right? You mentioned how India sees it. Canada is releasing an Indo-Pacific strategy, which is kind of consistent with the U.S. one. Japan sees it differently. Australia sees it differently. The Europeans and Koreans, I mean, everybody's got their own. I always wonder if, you know, the U.S., I guess, just because the DOD has CENTCOM and it's INDOPACOM and it's very clearly defined, like you said, that border between India and Pakistan is kind of the end of the Indo-Pacific. But if it went a little further because of, you know, not how the DOD divides the world and included the West Indian Ocean region, this would be a pretty, I think, important sub-region of the Indo-Pacific just because of those really deep commercial and historical ties that you described at the beginning.
And I think, you know, as far as the DOD is concerned, I mean, you're absolutely right. Those divisions and delineations tend to have an impact on how people subsequently, you know, view the sort of geography of these various regions. But I think, I mean, interestingly, in a sense, the combined maritime forces almost somewhat violate those distinctions and those separations because they combine 44 nations under an umbrella that brings together Asian, but also obviously European and other powers to look after issues of common interest in the Gulf, in the Arabian Sea, in the Red Sea, and the Bab el-Mandeb. So, I mean, that is, I think, an anecdotal point to mention. But I think beyond that, let's not forget that the Indo-Pacific has been, yes, bad news historically for the Gulf states. When Hillary Clinton first wrote about the U.S. pivot to Asia, you know, pivot away from the Middle East towards Asia, and so that implied for the Gulf states an eventual lessening of the U.S.'s security role and commitment in the region. And it really sparked, I think, anxieties among the Gulf states around fear of abandonment, essentially, by the United States. In the mind of I think, Gulf policymakers, the rise in geopolitical significance of the Indo-Pacific has always, come at the expense of the Middle East region, and therefore always meant and translated into a heightened risk of abandonment by the U.S., which essentially would, have placed the Gulf states facing Iran, essentially with less of a security commitment from the U.S. But I think, we're beyond that now. The Gulf states have since, I think, become much more confident. The way they approach Iran has evolved and matured, and I think has been quite successful over the past 2 years or so. And I think their own power projection capabilities have also evolved, and their confidence in applying military power and looking after their own interests and ensuring their own economic and defense resilience, I think, has also changed. And so I think anxieties about the U.S. pivot have been subdued, and I think the U.S. has made more of an effort to clarify what the parameters of its role are and to try and be consistent in that message. And I think that has resonated as well to a degree. But nevertheless, traditionally, the Indo-Pacific has been about a trade-off and has been perceived in the Gulf as implying, less United States in the Middle East and in favor of the Indo-Pacific.
Right. Okay, well, that actually leads to something else I want to talk about. Maybe this will be a little cheeky, but, in your previous answer, you talked about how leaders in the Gulf have been pretty consistent in not wanting to be seen as taking sides in this U.S.-China competition. And I'd agree, here in the UAE, it seemed for a long time, every time, Anwar Gargash, the presidential advisor, would give a speech, he would make that point, at least every English speech. And I think he was really trying to make, this very clear to the U.S. And I've traveled around the region a fair bit in the past few years. And one of the things that kept coming up is, especially in the tech realm, where people in every Middle Eastern country I visited would say, we don't understand when the U.S. says they don't want us to work with China on certain things, we're not sure what that encompasses. It seems to be almost everything across the tech sphere. We don't know where the red line is. Tell us where the red line is, and we can work with that. It looks like you said, I think the U.S. has been doing a better job of articulating how it sees the region, and I think it's also done a better job of articulating how it sees its relationship with China affecting especially in the Gulf, because this is where it resonates more on the issue of AI. And that's where I guess is maybe a little cheeky, because I'm asking you to look in a crystal ball on something that I don't know a whole lot about. I'm not sure how much reading on AI in strategic terms you're doing, but we saw that in the UAE G42 announced not long ago that they were divesting themselves of Chinese partnerships. And then about a week or 2 weeks ago, we're recording this May 23rd, in Saudi, the CEO of Alat made an interesting statement. He said if the U.S. asked, that they would consider divesting from Chinese tech cooperation as well. So do you think, at least in these more critical sectors, does this reflect a changing perception of how Gulf countries are looking at this U.S.-China competition?
So I think, you know, from the Gulf perspective, the geoeconomic domain is really a free-for-all. In the sense that, and I'll start, you know, with a counterexample. In the sense that you can have a defense and security partnership with the United States, you can host, you know, thousands of U.S. servicemen, you can be a major non-NATO ally of the United States, in security and defense terms. But in geoeconomic terms, that doesn't mean anything, because the U.S. could still slap on, you know, steel and aluminum tariffs that are going to affect Emirati and Bahraini exports of steel and aluminum to the United States, despite an adverse ruling by the WTO. It doesn't stop the United States from trying to depress oil prices by manipulating its strategic petroleum reserves. It doesn't stop the U.S. Congress from trying to legislate against OPEC, you know, and potentially gesture around things like 9/11 reparations for victim, you know, for families of victims targeting Saudi Arabia. And so in a sense, not to mention, you know, of course, the oil price cap that the G7 has put in place, the unprecedented weaponization of the U.S. dollar, of trade, of technology, U.S. export controls on semiconductors that are seemingly affecting Saudi Arabia's and the UAE's ability to obtain semiconductors and so on. The point that I'm trying to make is that there is a real disconnect, I think, between, you know, the defense realm and the geoeconomic realm for the Gulf states, in the sense that the patterns of rivalries and alignments look very different in those domains. And I think the same thing applies to China. Now, that obviously, you know, I'm not implying that the U.S. is public enemy number one, economically speaking, for the Gulf states, but to imply that despite, but to suggest rather that despite the strong defense and security partnership, there are real economic deep-seated problems and obstacles and challenges between the Gulf states and the United States. I think the same thing applies to China, in the sense that obviously China is their biggest oil export market. It plays a very significant role in the renewable energy ambitions on the technological and supply chain side of things. It's their largest trading partner, but it's also a competitor when it comes to, you know, steel and aluminum and petrochemicals, for example. And the Gulf states are obviously no happier than anyone else when it comes to Chinese unfair trade practices in that realm. And so there are, you know, frictions in almost any set of relations in the trade and investment sector. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to strategic sectors like AI, emerging disruptive technology, and so on, I think the Gulf states are, you know, going to be as opportunistic as anyone else. Clearly, when it comes to AI, I agree that there seems to be a preference for U.S. technology, partly because I think in recognition of the fact that the U.S., I think, is slightly more advanced than China in that domain. And I think, you know, those announcements by Saudi Arabia, by the UAE, are a response to growing U.S. pressure on these countries and the zero-sum game that the U.S. is trying to enforce when it comes to sectors deemed to be of strategic significance. But that doesn't, I think, you know, there's always a danger of over-extrapolating from announcements such as these. And I don't think it necessarily suggests a broader divesting of by the Gulf states vis-a-vis China, because when it comes to other, you know, tech domains of significance, of importance, like 5G, smart cities, and so on, China remains a very interesting and lucrative partner. And even when it comes to AI, I mean, you know, don't be surprised if we start, you know, on the education side of things. You know, you could very well have a bifurcated system within the UAE and Saudi Arabia, where you have you know, G42 and others exclusively investing in the US, but you know, maybe universities and education institutions signing MOUs and exchange programs with Chinese institutions instead. And so I think it's really a question of what's the best deal that these Gulf states can get, despite geopolitical tensions that they're working hard to navigate. But I wouldn't, you know, necessarily over extrapolate from that to suggest a complete shift in one direction or another.
Hassan, this has been really, really helpful. I think our listeners are going to take a lot away from this conversation. I know I have. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. I truly enjoyed this.
Awesome. Well, look, thanks. We got to do it again in person soon, either here in Bahrain. Either way, looking forward to it. To our listeners, thanks for joining us again. We've got one more episode left in this season. We'll be coming up pretty soon. Make sure you share it with everybody. All of the geopolitical enthusiasts in your life would love this. So we'll see you soon. And Hassan, hope I see you soon too. Thanks, everybody.